Penuel the Black Pen.
That's me, bro.
Thank you so much for making the time, brother.
I'm honored to have been invited. Shout out to you. Shout out to Scott. Shout out to the platform. And I hope I can leave my little signature
for
future generations and for future episodes when you guys hit 1 million subscribers.
Ooh. Hey. Yeah. Yeah. Million subscribers. Here we come. Yeah.
We've got a target for next month. Boom.
Too easy. Too easy.
Straight in.
Yeah.
What does the name Penuel the Black Pen mean to you? Particularly the Black Pen part.
My parents gave me two names, Penuel Lungelo. Penuel is Hebrew from the Bible, from Genesis. It's a place where Jacob wrestled with an angel and declared thereafter, I've seen the face of God. So it means the face of God. I think it's quite a deep name.
Yeah.
I don't know how my mom stumbled upon it. Lungelo becomes poignant in the sense of, I was born in 86. So just before 94, just before 1990 and 94 with democracy, Lungelo is a Nguni or an isiZulu word for right, like your right to live, your right to expression. So I thought those were really deep names. Mm. Lungelo doesn't mean much to me, sadly.
Oh.
I do like the name Penuel. It is unique. It's different. It's not common. So I'd hold on to that and I'd keep that into my adult years. The Black Pen started because I used to draw. I used to be very decent at sketching. And at some point, I actually thought I was going to be a visual artist professionally.
Nice.
And I used to specialize in drawing in Black Pen. After that, I started rapping. I was a big fan of hip hop. And that became my name because, you know, I drew in Black Pen and I was rapping in Black Pen. And it was Penuel the Black Pen.
Jeez.
And that stuck. And I'm here now. I've written books as well under my own publishing company. The Black Pen Publishers. And it's just the name that I think makes sense to me. A lot of people think it has to do with race, which yeah. I guess I kind of understand because I speak or I discuss a lot of political content. But it actually has to do with the fact that I used to draw in Black Pen and then I became a rapper and then I started writing books.
I think it works. It fits.
Yeah, yeah. And I wear black all the time now. Yeah. So you know what I mean?
Do you still rap?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Time, priority.
Were you any
discovered,
good?
Discovered politics. Well, rapping can be quite political, but you know what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
You discovered more like, what was the journey? How'd you make the transition or why?
I mean, from a sketch artist to hip hop, a lot of creativity there, and you just switched and you went to corporate finance.
Yeah. I think a lot of us have dreams when we're young and we're exposed to platforms and skills where you basically better than other kids. So
okay.
Then people are like, oh, you're so fast, Scott. You should become an athlete.
Mm.
You know, Stan, you're so great at computers. You should go and study computer science. And many of us are multi-talented. And as we get older and with the whole pursuit of chasing money and a family, you're almost forced to kill some of your skills and your talents.
Mm.
Number one. Number two, we are limited in the time that we have.
Okay.
And you want to invest. Most people invest the bulk of their time and creativity in what makes them the most money, which is actually sad that money kind of, you know, determines where you invest your time and energy. For other people that are privileged, you invest your time and energy and skills into what actually stimulates you the most.
Yeah.
And what inspires you. Social media came in and disrupted many of us. And for me, most of my creative energy has been spent in that and spent in speaking to human beings, trying to figure out my worldview and trying to share my worldview with as many people are willing to listen. So in that, it takes away from songwriting. It takes away from going into studio. But if you look at what hip hop meant for me growing up, hip hop was an institution of education before entertainment.
Okay.
My mom was a teacher her whole life. My dad was a football coach his whole life, and he used to mentor young boys. And I think I've just taken on the family business of education. I think my brother as well. My sister also used to coach at some point. What's the best platform now to educate? Is it hip hop? Probably not.
No, it's not.
It's probably podcasting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think I've just morphed into that because from writing books, I now write most of my thoughts on social media. I've probably written more articles and more thoughts in that format arguably made more money off online in that format than selling books. So
yeah,
I think it's just morphing the things that I'm passionate about into different platforms.
You have been labeled many things.
Many bad things, yes.
Yes, a misogynist, come on. Racist.
Come on.
List is endless.
Oh, is that Trump or... Oh, you mean me?
You.
My bad. Well, my bad.
Apparently you do have some Trump complex.
Come on.
Yeah. And all of this, I can't help but...
What does that mean?
Hey, ask the followers.
Okay, carry on. Yeah.
They'll tell you in the comment section. Where do you draw the line between freedom of speech and social responsibility? You having been in the middle of all this kind of backlashes and between your views being misunderstood or being interpreted in a certain way.
Yeah. I do try to operate within the laws of any country that I'm in.
Yeah.
Not because I respect them, but because I respect the consequences. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to be fined. But where I feel certain laws are wrong, I do try to challenge them as diplomatically as I can in the betterment of where I think society should head.
Okay.
Outside of that, everything for me is fair play. I think being an independent thinker, being a critical thinker is something that every person with half a brain cell should pursue. The reason we're here today and have any type of civilization or progress is because certain people were brave enough to go against the status quo, of which the most popular one is probably Jesus Christ for Christians. For many others, they could reference Tupac, you could reference Steve Biko, you could reference the ANC and other liberation movements. These were people that not only went against what was popular, but also went against what was legal at the time. And if you study history, you realize for the world to get better, you have to play in the realm of discomfort. Mm. And in doing that, it can't be that everyone's going to applaud you, because that just means you're regurgitating what everyone kind of knows. I think the world is much better than it used to be, but I think it's far from where it could be, even in our lifetime. And for that to happen, certain voices need to say things that are deemed uncomfortable. And I become one of those. But to draw a line, like I said, mostly I try to not be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And then morality is subjective. But for me, I will say and do the things that I expect others to do and say unto me.
So you're happy with people taking some of your advices and implementing them in their life? Like, let's say, for example, multiple wives, not having a job and working for yourself. Are you happy with people taking those advices and implementing them with the risks that those may come with?
So number one, I don't support multiple wives.
Oh.
I think the average man should strive to have one woman and commit. I think the average man should strive to have two children, especially in the capitalistic context that we live in today. I live differently from other people and it is my life.
Okay.
But people need to understand that my life has consequences and most people are not willing to live with those. Easy example. You make a swear word and your child copies you. Oh, shit. Right. It's like, no, stop. The child is imitating you. And the child's like, yeah, but dad, you said it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you imitating the swear words, but not the me providing for the family? Why are you imitating the swear words, but not imitating the other responsibilities? Don't be convenient.
Right.
So I'm not a role model because people probably can't deal with what it comes with to live the life I live.
Mm.
I try to offer advice that I think is in the interest of society as a whole. But I also do allow for people that are different to say, look, if you can live with the consequences, I mean, go hijack cars, bro. If you don't mind being shot and going to jail, hey, who are we to tell you that it's wrong?
Yeah.
Since you clearly believe that it's right. With that being said, you know, I've got a book, Pendulism Principles, which is my worldview. And I would love for as many human beings as possible to implement those things in their lives. Most of it is universal principles, number one. But the other important thing is my advice is not for everyone because human beings are different.
Okay.
But it is for the hypothetical average person out there to live a better life than they lead currently, because most of them are not really happy.
What would you consider like your top three rule charter, for example, from the Pendulism? I was going to ask you about Pendulism, so we might as well lean into that a little bit. What would you consider? You don't have to go through the whole thing, but what would you consider your, for want of a better phrase, first principles? Like, what's your primary principles that you try to live by?
The first one in my book, because I've got 30, but I need to add more, Own Your Mind. And it speaks about the concept of from birth, given a name, given an ID number, citizenship, normally given a religion. And from there, people define how you should live. You should go to school, go to tertiary, get a wife. So I ask people to please take a step back. Imagine a blank canvas and look at the world out there and decide, where do I want to go? How do I want to live? And what works best for me without serving people's agendas that may not be for the best for me and to the detriment of my family. So Own Your Mind is a big one. Another big one for me is money is not real, especially in the world we live in. We've moved so far from what money was meant to be. Money is meant to be a store of value, a unit of account, a medium of exchange. But it's been poisoned by things like compound interest or even simple interest, speculation, inflation. And the elite manipulate money to serve their agendas. If we can transcend money and get back to what it was meant to be, which is true value, I think more people would be happier, because especially the poor, they generate a lot of value every day in various ways, but they are not compensated for it in a way that makes sense, because they've been forced to believe that money is the measure of value. And it shouldn't be. So money is not real. It's a human created concept.
Tell my partner
and
that.
Construct.
I mean, that my partner needs to know that. My value doesn't depend on the value, the size of my wallet, you know?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in this world, it does.
So money is not real. People should look into value becomes number two. Number three, I would speak about maybe let's say community. Community, I think, for me, is the future of the world. More than nations or countries that also were created by human beings. And communities have to do with shared values, shared ideals, a shared vision. And if you can note those down, I think you've won. For a lot of other people, one of the principles that stands out is a foreigner mindset. I implore people everywhere they go to stop thinking like a local, even in your own home, and to start thinking like an immigrant with what opportunities are here, how do I get by, how do I get ahead? And if you are too comfortable and you can't see it, travel to a place that's different to experience what it feels like to be an other. And that sometimes helps you even when you come back home to actually see all the opportunities that you've taken for granted or that you hadn't even noticed. So those would be the three. Own your mind. Money is not real, or rather choose value over money. And number three is community. And then I'll add a bonus being the foreigner's mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. Those sounds like all good principles.
Yeah.
Would we ever see a school of pendulism?
I'd like to think so. It may not be in the form of a formal institution.
Okay.
Because I've been mulling around building a church or some church. Type of religious structure, because, you know, my worldviews are a form of religion in themselves. Building a school, which is easier to infiltrate people's minds.
Okay.
I mean, many people attend Anglican schools. I think some of our best schools in the country are Anglican or Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
But no one thinks about them in that sense that, so you're being indoctrinated by, you know, they're just like, it's a good school. They have good academic results. They've got great sports. But essentially the ethos of the school is those principles. So I have thought about doing that, but the world has changed and the schooling systems need to be disrupted. So do I copy and paste what's been done before, even though I don't think it's relevant for the future? Do I do some form of online schooling? Do we infiltrate people through podcasts and social media? Do we create some type of apprenticeship program? I'm trying to figure that out, and the goalposts are constantly shifting, but it is something I've thought of a lot.
From that school, what would be, if you were to create like a crash, what would be the basic module for the young kids that would come into that school? Whatever the structure would be, whether it's a formal schooling system, whether it's books, whatever that format would be, but what curriculum or content would you give to very preschool kids?
I think the objective of being a parent ideally should be helping your children become independent as quickly as possible. And I think the schooling system, number one, functions very much as a daycare center because parents have to go and work for the industrial system.
Yeah.
Number two, it imparts some kind of basic skills, not a lot. Most of the 12 years of basic are just literally to keep you busy while your parents are working, because you could concatenate that into maybe 5 years, if we're being fully honest.
Mm.
I think children from as early as they can be conscious and teachable and they can repeat stuff should be simulating what we call adulthood. And that means real life case studies, apprenticeship. I mean, how does Mufasa teach Simba how to hunt? Sends him to school for 12 years, to learn geography and history, and then to tertiary to specialize in hunting. And then after that, he must put in his CV to see if there's a company that's hiring hunters. No,
not a chance.
He takes him to the field and he tells him, you know, those are the animals. Those ones are a bit dangerous. Go for the little one because you're still a bit small.
Yeah.
This is how you sharpen your claws on. So I think from even a creche perspective, of which, look, Finland has done a lot of work in disrupting the whole concept of grades and even homework, which I think is horrible as a concept. And it's how do we simulate real life at the lowest possible level?
Yeah.
So that children understand I've got responsibilities, I've got rights. If I do something, I get rewarded. If I do something bad, there are consequences. And in that, you can add some level of creativity so that you know, we can enjoy our existence. You can do work, but you can be singing at the same time. You can be sitting at a desk and in between waiting for someone to respond to an email. You can draw a picture. So how do we create a dynamic life, number one? Number two, part of my conceptual work around the school was the Japanese concept of ikigai, which is finding your purpose. The center of what are you good at? What are you passionate about? What is the world willing to pay you for? And what does the world need? How do we take every individual child using advanced models, especially algorithms, to track your development almost daily, if not weekly or monthly and annually, to see where would you be best suited to add value to the world as a whole? You're tall. Sports comes easily to you. You can dunk. Let's get you to lean more into basketball. The next kid, reading is just a breeze for them. The maths is, why are they still stuck in grade one? They need to be moving and being challenged and adding value as early as they can in the things that they are really, really good at. And anytime they shift and they change, the algorithm sort of should shift and change in terms of their responsibilities to society.
Interesting.
There's a few things that resonate for me there because so I've got a little kid now. He's only like 21 months
or so. Congrats.
And thanks. And
first child.
Yeah.
Jeez, congrats.
When and done, I hope. Yeah.
Tell him he's late. Why are you saying congrats?
Tell him.
He's late. At his age is dead.
Come on. But like
not for me to judge.
So a few things that resonate for me. One is the issue of independence, having your child to be as independent as possible. We're kind of on the same page. I don't think in terms of independence. So I think of in terms of I use the sort of Greek philosophy of know thyself, in the sense like you want your kid to be as dedicated to themselves as much as possible, in the sense of their interests, their passions, and follow that as much as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And then in terms of like your and that comes out differently. Like all the great movers and shakers in the world have always been true individuals, right? Yeah. Every person is a true individual. It just gets washed over as you grow older, I guess, in terms of, through the institutions we're speaking of, for better or for worse, you know? In terms of the understanding the world, again, I don't want my kid to be independent from me at 8 years old, but I do want them to be literate in this. I don't mean book literate. I mean, in terms of when they look out into the world, they understand that. They have a sense of how politics kind of works. They have a sense of how the economy kind of works. If they look at the stock exchange, they have a sense of how it works, like what the numbers mean, and so on and so forth. They understand history, not in sense of like regurgitating quotes and leaders and names and dates, and just in the sense they understand the ebb and flow of planet Earth, you know, and how it actually works. And that for me is, that's kind of your basis. If a kid, any individual understands generally how things works, understands rhythms, understands context, you can kind of build anything off of that if they've been an individual. So that kind of stuff is interesting to me in the sense of, institutions are, they're kind of necessary, but then your metrics as to whether someone is successful or not is kind of where things get shaky. Is like, how does that actually work? If they're not interested in being a millionaire and they're happy living somewhere else, like growing their own food, they're successful in their context.
100%.
So, you know, it's that sort of space. And that fits within your viewpoint that you're looking at. I mean, my question would be, if you want to institutionalize that viewpoint, that in turn becomes part of the pattern that develops out, right? So you have a sense of like, in time, that'll also become an institutionalized viewpoint that needs to be kind of broken down.
It must constantly be challenged. And it must constantly change, in my opinion. And I don't think the institutions, they were built for a reason in the industrial age. They haven't adjusted as the world and the economy adjusts. And that's my problem. Why would you have an issue with your child being independent at the age of 8?
Well, in the sense, I suppose they're just not, maybe they're not capable of taking care of themselves.
How would you know?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to try with my kid. You're,
but why 18?
Oh, 8. I said 8. Oh, you mean, oh, why socially is it 18? I don't know.
No, for you, why would you be comfortable with 18 and not 8?
18, you're a little bit older. You're at least more physically able to either defend yourself or manage yourself in the world. Sure.
So it's a physical thing for you?
That would be part of it, yeah.
Okay. Because my whole thing is, if the 8-year-old shows competency at an 18, 25-year-old level, why not let them be? Why not let them vote? Why not? Because my whole thing from the creche argument is, once the child understands that you have rights, but you have responsibilities and there are consequences, and they fully embrace that, I think they should be allowed to earn their way into whatever freedom that they need. Similarly, I think a 50-year-old that is not politically literate, doesn't understand the impact of their vote, is dependent on the state, that's a child to me. So that person shouldn't be allowed to make certain decisions.
That's where the median of society comes in and policymaking comes in. You're creating a median in the sense that, okay, well, yeah, there might be exceptions to the rule where a 5 or 8-year-old is capable of doing what a 50-year-old is, and that 50-year-old in turn may not be capable of doing what an 8-year-old can.
Yeah.
But there's a median involved, right? So as a society, individuals different. Individuals can be and do and whatever is whatever. There's no limits really, but as a society, it's different, right?
Don't you think the median is designed by the institutions, and that's why we need to break them? So the child who's 8 and independent is an outlier because they did work on their own or their circumstances. But if we had an institution that was training them for the real world, the median would shift.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Happy. Yeah. Well, congrats again, by the way. You'd like to have more?
Maybe one more. Maybe we'll see.
Okay. Good luck.
I'm enjoying him though. Yeah, he's great.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Okay.
You're big on independency and people who do for themselves and not rely on the state. And you mentioned this as part of what would make part of the curriculum for kids that would come through the education system. And I'm wondering, where do you feel as a country we got it wrong in creating citizens that are largely dependent on the state versus those that can do for themselves? Is it an education system that we didn't structure very well? Is it how the economic system of the country is just built to create people who are dependent on the state so that certain businesses can make money? Where did we get it wrong?
Two places. Number one, historically, we lived in a feudal system where the kings would own the land and we'd have the chiefs, Izinduna, and then the so-called peasants or the ordinary subjects. And that's the mindset that Africans have generally had. We see it today, even in the way we still idolize political leaders and how people would call Winnie Madikizela Mandela umama, as if she's the queen. And Jacob Zuma is ubaba, the king. So we still have that mindset as Africans in particular. Then the second thing becomes the social welfare system that the ANC came with in 1994, which didn't help because you're not teaching people a sense of responsibility for taking care of themselves. But, if you vote for us, the government will take care of you. If you need something, we'll help you. It's good if you want to consolidate power, of course. It really sucks if you're trying to create a productive nation. So the historic one is a bit tough because it's something that has become cultural over time. The one that we have now can be fixed through scrapping big chunks of social welfare where we can, or working our way out of them in the sense that, number one, if you have a child, you will get a child grant if you don't have money. However, you need to offer something to society, go volunteer at the school and. Once you've been volunteering at the school, once you've accumulated some type of experience, it should be easier to then convert you into some type of an employee. How we incentivize that is the more volunteering you do, the higher the child grant. But once you get to a certain level of being able to make money, we completely take it away. I think would be a much better system. However, I understand that it's not a South African thing, but anyone who actually is in the business of power does not want a strong nation because you become susceptible to being overthrown. It's easier to have childlike subjects that follow your worldview, and you create policies and you create propaganda that they regurgitate to you. What do you want? We want jobs. Mm. Like, no, you don't want jobs. It's just, it's the script you've heard so many times that when you asked, it's the one that you say back, like being in school. People don't want jobs. People want a quality of life. What does that look like? It could be land. Mm. Maybe you don't need land. Mm. It could be a nice car. But do you need a nice car if public transport is brilliant? It could be your children going to school. But if school is social media, does your child really need to go to school? You might need great healthcare. But what if we're all living healthy like the Japanese and we eat well and exercise is integrated into lifestyle? Do you then need like great medical aid? Probably not. So people just want a quality of life. And the conversation needs to be around, how do we get that for the average person? And then get them to take ownership of their minds. Know thyself. Mm. So that it's like, oh, no, I want to be a leader. I want to be independent. No, I actually am a brilliant follower. I just need to find the right type of leader and then contribute my value to their agenda.
Interesting. So would this be part of the reason why you would call BEE psychological sedative? Having created a system which was supposed to get Black people be part of the economy, but in turn has created some form of dependency on the state. Question there is, how did we get it wrong and how can we fix it? Do you believe that BEE can be restructured and fixed for Black people to contribute meaningfully into the economy?
So BEE, I don't think is a psychological sedative. I think that's social welfare in particular. The grants, the free schooling, the free healthcare, feeding schemes, free house, NSFAS, and this entitlement culture that I have an ID number in South Africa, therefore, give me, give me, give me. Mm. I don't even need to vote for the ANC. Just give me, give me, give me. I think that's destructive to the mind, number one. Black economic empowerment was a decent idea at the time. And for many people that still may not know, it was not devised by the ANC. It was not devised by liberation movements. It was devised by the bigger conglomerates that were running South Africa at the time. Your Sanlam, your Old Mutual, your Rembrandt Group, which is Remgro today, and a couple of others, Anglo-American probably being the biggest. They saw that there was a potential transition and they needed to manage it. Because any good entrepreneur, any good business person tries to mitigate the risk of any type of change, whether it's load shedding and you get generators, whether Trump is coming in, how do we get favored by the Americans, BRICS is coming, how do we make sure that we don't alienate the Russians and the Chinese? So you try to move and plan ahead. And Clem Santer would, under Anglo-American, would come up with this model, which would eventually give birth to Black economic empowerment. The idea was to say, look, give some of these political guys and some Black people a piece of the big companies so that they understand what's at stake to be lost if they go on a full-scale socialism program and why it's not best. Some could argue that that's a form of a bribe, and also to preserve their businesses. What would happen, obviously, with greed and just human error as a natural thing, is people would then hoard these opportunities that were meant for the majority. BEE would be commissioned. Later on, it would be revised to become triple BEE, broad-based, which was meant to filter down to the people. Sadly, it hasn't done what it was meant to do. The one thing people don't understand is that BEE has a couple of pillars, of which of the pillars, two of them are the most problematic.
Okay.
The one is ownership. That's shares. That's the one that probably gets the most hype. Cyril Ramaphosa, Tokyo Sekgwale, Saki Matsozo, Omar Patrice, these guys just got shares for being Black and being politically connected. That is just one pillar. It's a big one. It's very visible. Another one is preferential procurement, or what we'd call tenders now, because we have tenderpreneurs, about Edwin Sodi and all these guys, where certain state work, government work, serving the people, building a road, building a hospital, that is service to society, is being given to politically connected people who are paying bribes, brown envelope to their political mates. They are not delivering a good service. They are looting the money and that also gets a bad face. But it was meant to say, if there's a tender out there, you could give it to the traditional white guy who was rich. But please, can you incorporate Black people so they can also deliver to the state and serve the nation, etc.
You know what they say, road to hell is paved with good intentions.
These are facts. I think arguably every dictator and every evil person, if you look at their genesis, they really had good intentions. Employment equity has done a lot of good as a pillar. That's ensuring that we have black doctors, black accountants, black actuaries, black CAs, and pushing towards that. Yes, a lot of white people would complain that, but I'm competent. I want to get the job. And now they're just hiring black women who may not be as competent, but it was to try and fix the imbalances of the past. That if we allow black senior management and executive and white senior management and executives to hire, they will only hire white people. Not even because of racism, but it's because that's all they know. It's the only culture they know. I'm chilling with Scott in an interview. Which school did you go to? Oh, snap. I went to that school. Do you still play rugby? We have a cultural alignment. The black girl sitting here is from Limpopo. She speaks a language I don't even understand. What does she do on the weekend? Do you know rugby? No, I don't. Like,
the thing with BE is like there's a larger system that was required to be enabled for it to work appropriately, or is to work as initially intended. And that was the education. Yes, from a leadership perspective is one aspect. For the education perspective, for the whole nation needed to kind of meet it as well. And what that hasn't happened. That's kind of where the problem is sitting. Is there's if you're not solving the education problem, and I'm not talking like everywhere, rurals everywhere. I'm just saying generally, even in your cities and the surrounding areas, there's no reason why the education can't be top notch, and that sort of aspect of development that was meant to support the restructuring and the necessary corrective measures in the country wasn't really enabled the way it should have been enabled, or at least from an ideological perspective,
it should
have been enabled much further. And this is why now, 30 years down the line, you're kind of in a space where it's not really corrected, and you're still dealing with, you know, I was gonna have a snub at interns, but
jeez, don't do that. We love the interns.
not these interns. I mean,
interns, not these ones, the other ones. Yes.
You know, like youngsters coming out of schools now, you're like, okay, like different worlds, eh? Like, I don't even mean just age perspective. I mean, you're in terms of how they can how they're thinking about their role in the market and how they can contribute and receive from the market is very different from the way I grew up.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So skills development is another pillar of BEE, which unfortunately, yes, it's not aligned to the economy. But if you look at how many black, colored, Indian, white female doctors, actuaries, lawyers, high professionals we've churned out since 94, it is absolutely brilliant. And it comes in the form of NSFAS and some type of study grant and trying to expand access to university education. So again, when you look at the other pillars, there's a lot of good that has come from BEE.
Okay.
But again, the problem is this ownership leg and this preferential procurement. And if it was done better, we'd see a difference. I don't believe in BEE anymore, even retrospectively. At some point, I did defend it and I felt, you know, it's got some good. And if we could just tweak it, it would do better. Historically, when you look at the world, etc., if you look at South Africa today and you look at the small businesses that are making the most gains, it is not because they got a leg up from apartheid or the British colonial system, or it is immigrants who come from extreme poverty, who don't have a grant, who don't have a free house, who don't have all these benefits. They come in, they see an opportunity to sell product, to move certain goods, to offer a certain service, and they bootstrap and they do it hard and they learn on the job. Guy came in as a qualified nurse and he's learning how to fix tires because that's all he could do. And he learns over time from fixing tires to servicing a car, to putting a car together, to whatever the case may be. We do need a merit-based system. It's always best, but we do need the platforms that allow for apprenticeship, real apprenticeship, learning on the job. We need real skills development. And to Scott's point, what would happen from 94 is we speak skills development and BEE, but then we speak the decimation of like technical skills institutions. Like, what the hell? Something different would happen in Singapore, as an example, where when they started shifting, they didn't focus on we need more doctors and lawyers and engineers. They were like, we need more plumbers and electricians. And once we've got that sorted, you can build your own house. You can fix your own car. That's sorted. Then we can go, because a lot of these high professions were never designed to be saturated. You don't need an excess of doctors, because once you do, you then end up exporting them. People don't need a doctor every single day. People don't need an engineer every single day, or CA every single day. So trying to focus on that and getting all the kids to chase that is a mess. Every kid, as an example, wants to be a DJ, wants to make music for Mapiano, wants to play for Bafana or the Springboks. All those kids chasing that need to live in a house with bricks where you can fix the plumbing and the electrical work and drive a car. And you're telling me the bulk of kids with the matric certificate can't plant a vegetable. They can't service a car. Like the things that we actually need on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So we realize that our education, or the content of our education, doesn't speak to the real needs that every one of us should be able to fix a pothole because we live in that country. Every one of us should understand how electricity works because we've had load shedding for 17 years. So it's like, oh, those basics we all know because our education system was aligned to the problems that we have. But when it's not, and everyone wants to do robotics and coding.
Ish.
Why, but they don't know how to.
Why are we coders catching strays now?
So
here's a. why are we coders catching strays now?
You're an elite skill. You're not a necessity in the real third, second world, unfortunately.
This might turn into conversation, but here's a controversial idea. So I think about it now and again, and I always get nailed with it. So maybe I shouldn't put it out there. But anyway,
jeez, watch yourself.
Remember,
you'll get cancer.
Remember in the days of conscription, right? Military conscription.
Yeah.
Obviously, that isn't required these days. It's a very different economic system, very different political system. But the idea of conscription isn't lost on me in the sense of, like, you could make it economic conscription. So in the sense that leaving education out of it, once kids leave school, there should be some sort of onboarding into the economy, whether it's whatever the economy requires at that time, whether it's plumbing, electric, road building, whatever the case may be. There's some sort of onboarding into the economy that's skills based. Could be coders, man, you know. But I mean, in the sense,
shame, it could be coders.
But you know, assuming coders. The government stays on top of what's required within their particular country and the requirements for the economy, that's a skill based work sponsored by the government. For real outputs and real developments for individuals to learn skills, and also kind of just give them a pathway into the economy, as opposed to saying, you know, finish school, then you kind of kick him out the door and say, go find a job. That's not as useful. Mm-hmm. You know,
it would be very brilliant. Look, I criticize and I bash and I kind of hate the ANC a lot, but I can't lie about the efforts that they've tried. They really have. They just obviously. There's greed and corruption and mismanagement and the like. You've got programs like YES, you've got programs like TSEPO 5000, I think, where they've tried to say, look, if you have some type of qualification, we'll try and get you to intern somewhere in the real world and we'll pay you some type of stipend.
Yeah.
Does it operate like military conscription? Is it real skills transfer? We don't really know. But, you know, I think that was the idea.
Yeah.
For me, I'd want to bring it to a crash level. How do we get kids from a crash level? And this is not rocket science again. The Jewish community, the Muslim community, and many others, their kids by default and design are forced after school to go work in the shop, are forced after school to go and help dad in the workshop. And Afrikaans kids that go to the farm on the weekend, you may not know it, but that's hands-on skills training. By the time you're 18, you've got 10 years of farming experience. Where did you get it? Every weekend, bro, I was working every day after school. I had to do 2 hours of. I hated it. But geez, when I look at my peers, I'm like, why are you guys struggling with this thing? Because it's so simple to me. We just, this focus on let children be children, children must play, I think is propaganda that's designed to keep kids as far away as possible from things that actually add real value to their lives. And what's hypocritical and ironic for me is if you look at the school's system, there's such a heavy focus on mathematics. There's such a heavy focus in some of the top schools on sports. And if you look at the amount of investment, financial, physical, mental, that they put into extra maths classes, extra exams, going on the rugby field and bleeding and traveling. And why is that fine? Why is that part of children being children? But a child can't go work for 30 minutes at a shop. A child can't go on a farm and just go help the harvesters on. And you're like, no, but children can't. And you're like, this seems more hectic to me than that. But that is more life skills than this. So what if I played first team cricket? But I'm never going to use it because the odds of me becoming a professional cricket player are slim, limited. But if at school, every Friday, we all work in the garden or we're looking after the livestock or we're going to an auction or we're selling some product or we're learning how to market stuff or we're creating online marketing, selling spaces, that is more valuable for a child in the long run, no matter where they end up. But when you suggest these things, let children be children. And I'm like, okay, no problem.
Becomes a huge problem. Yeah. But so we get the kids to have the skills. This guy grows up in a house that knows how to do carpentry. They get their hands on. How do they scale? How do they get to a point where the skill they have is scalable to a point where they can have a company or they can make enough money to support a lifestyle or a family if they do have? Because if you look at maybe, let's say the economy that we have in South Africa, I think it's more tailored for B2B instead of B2C. It's very hard to scale businesses that are customer facing. The B2B businesses seem to be doing very well.
Yeah.
Now, if we train these kids to have the skills, which essentially would mean service a customer and get something in return, but they'll soon hit a ceiling because that market is very tough to penetrate. Are we not setting them up to say, have the skills, but you're limited to how much you can scale?
Why do you want them to scale?
Why? If they don't scale, they don't pass it on. They just pass a skill.
No, but why would you want a small business that services 10 people to scale to 100, 10,000?
Not necessarily even tens of thousands. Let's say a medium size, maybe 50. In that way, that's something this guy can leave.
Are you saying it's difficult to scale to 50 clients?
Yeah.
Why do you think that's the case?
This is from the businesses I've seen. Sure. Those that make it are B2B, and those that struggle are directly looking at a customer. They have a customer that they need to service. And that tends to consume the resources, the skills, and the founder or the business owner then gets a bit overwhelmed because they can't scale. They need more resources. They need capital to hire more people to service. It does not become scalable in the true sense.
You think they lack the skills to scale?
Could be skills, could be capital. It's a number of problems. It's not just one problem.
Capital is a skill, the skill to raise capital.
Then that's another skill that they may need to acquire so they can raise capital. My point is when we train for these skills, I think we then put a ceiling because at a particular point, they can't grow.
Okay. You're saying they just lack the skill of scalability, running a business. All they have is this ability to do something.
Yeah.
And you have a problem with that.
Yes.
And you believe we should add this additional.
Yes. So the businesses can be scalable.
Okay.
Stanley's hard capitalist side coming out there. Like, nothing. Scale, make more money.
There was something you asked me, Stan, offline, and maybe this becomes my chance to answer it. I've said it on two platforms that you've seen, and you've said it grates your fucking tits and it pisses you off. I think small business is a scam. And on both platforms, I never got to unpack what I meant by that.
Yes.
I'm going to try to be as brief as I can be.
With this question, I was actually alluding to that.
Nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. Thank you for trying to maneuver, but it didn't really work. I got you to answer your own question. I think in a functional economy, you don't need small businesses. I think you have a couple of big businesses that are married to what society needs and that are able to invest in kids to have the skills that are required, and then they absorb them into the companies to go and serve people. I think the idea of getting people to believe in small businesses is very misleading because most small businesses are not meant to scale beyond a certain point. They just not. It's not necessary. Again, you become oversaturated because if everyone wants to start a Pick and Pay or a Checkers, or there just isn't enough of a market for that. Similarly, if everyone can become a carpenter or can fix cars, those businesses kind of collapse. What is available are institutions, businesses that should be able to absorb people with skills that are needed out there, and then to pay them relatively fairly, and then to carry on looking for opportunities out there that big businesses, people with capital can come in, build companies, hire the people that have the skills and resolve it. For most people, they go into small business for two reasons or a couple of reasons. But number one, it's they can't get a job. Literally. It's not because they wanted to start a business. It was survival. And this is the only thing I could do. For other people, I guess it's, you know, I hate being in corporate. You know, I want to kind of manage my life. Maybe I quit and I start a small business for that. Those ones tend to fail for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, they maybe want to build a business and they want to become rich. And maybe they have a unique idea or process that they think the world needs and that they think they can make money from. Those are the reasons. But for almost all of these reasons, there's a solution to them. It's like this thing of, if you want to be a millionaire, you must start a business. You don't have to. You can actually go join a corporate, add a lot of value, move up the ranks and start getting paid in cash and in share options.
Mm.
I mean, there are billionaires today. I always see these memes. You can't become a billionaire if you don't own a business. That's not true. We've got billionaires that are CEOs of your Microsofts, your NVIDIAs and your whatever. So that's rubbish. In this country, most rich people by far, I just don't know the data, but if I had to guess, 80%, this is a wild guess, 80% of people that are millionaires in this country are millionaires from employment, not from owning businesses at all.
That's true.
So when you're telling people go into small businesses, you're leading them to fail for a couple of reasons, but the most important one is the environment is not enabling for small business. So you spoke about ceilings and you are right about some of them, one of them being the lack of skills to scale. The other one is just legislation and regulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
The big boys don't want competition. Once I build a pharmaceutical company that starts making shifts, you best believe government's going to come in for compliance, you know, for the consumers. We feel like you're not doing the right things. Then when you realize, you find out, no, but it's the big guys that are actually funding the politicians to push this regulation.
Yeah.
Who decides that cannabis gets legalized or not? It's a few people who are positioned at the right time with the right type of capital and infrastructure and resources and land to make a killing from cannabis. It's not tell the small kids, guys, go into cannabis. There's opportunities. You're lying. You're lying to the kids. You're setting them up for failure. So it becomes a scam in that way. If you're going to tell people go into small business to try and survive, nothing wrong with that, because you can't get a job, because you're limited in what you can do. So go and set up a spaza shop, go set up a stall, go cut some hair.
Mm.
If maybe you get a lot of customers because you have a particular skill, maybe you can hire your friend. Now there's two of you. Now there's three of you. Cool. If you get to 10 employees, geez, you manage to buy a car, boy, and you can afford a house. Okay, you've made it. That's it. But to expect you to now scale into one day you become Google, Facebook, I think distracts kids from what they should be focusing on, which is number one, acquiring skills that society needs. And then number two, finding the platform where you can offer the skills in the best way possible. Is it in starting a business? Maybe, probably not.
Mm.
Is it going to find the type of company that already has the tools, the marketing, the resources? Go do that. And then number three, make sure that you've been compensated fairly as far as possible for that. And if we can get kids to think in that mindset, they'll move away from, I think even part of the reason we can't scale a lot of things we're doing is because everyone wants to operate in silos.
Yeah.
Do I need to buy my own equipment when everyone and their grandmother has got a camera and a microphone, where this stuff sits fallow the bulk of the day, where someone else could be coming and we're just taking those resources and we're scaling so we can go international?
Yeah.
Instead of everyone has to build a studio, everyone wants to have their own sports team. It's not really necessary. And even the guys that are highly skilled that have built great businesses, I think the South African market is limited and many of them end up having to go abroad. Some of the most talented employees in nuclear, in construction, in IT are based around the world, are from South Africa, in places like China, Japan, the United Arab Emirates, parts of Europe. I mean, there are some big boys in tech in Silicon Valley from SA. We've got some talented people, but the environment here is just not good enough for them, even if you were to pay them well. And then our biggest companies had to leave because we don't have a big enough capital pool, being Naspers, moving to Amsterdam. We just don't have enough money to fund them for the ideas that they're trying to implement globally.
All right, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. The only thing that made my blood boil is statement that says small businesses are a scam. I agree. I mean, chances are a lot of people would have a much better mental health with a 9-to-5 than they would with running a small business.
Yes.
That I agree with. It's the language that we use when we speak of small businesses and startups and entrepreneurship that's problematic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's the small businesses themselves. And many times when you said small businesses are a scam, it wasn't the concept of, it was the businesses themselves that came across as
the word you scam that
scam. I think that, look, he has a huge channel. In itself, it could be categorized as a startup media company.
Mm.
And I'm like, what's the scam in that?
Yeah.
Right? But in itself, I don't see the scam. Unless there is, please do share what's the scam in the convo,
sure.
In the convo podcast, sure. In the Peñol show, what's the scam there? Because yes, the language we use to say, go into entrepreneurship, it's the best thing you'll ever, that language is wrong. I totally agree with it. Yes, if you want to say that, do say, look, you probably won't sleep, you'll lose weight, you'll lose friends, family is going to be angry at you because that's what that environment demands of you. But that in itself doesn't mean that startups or small businesses are a scam.
If I'd said that, would you have paid attention? Would you have genuinely wanted to have the conversation, or would you have just breezed past, like, oh, he's right, and keep moving?
No, I would have. I would have wanted you to expand more.
No, I'm just saying, if you were to say palatable things to society, do you think they'd pay attention?
No.
Or do you think sometimes we have to say things that are slightly provocative to get them to zone and be like, what the hell do you mean? And now everyone's paying attention. And in that, you then impart the education.
So you captured me.
That's not what I'm saying. Just, if you want to be captured, that's on you. But sometimes, I get criticized a lot for it.
Yeah.
People speak about clickbaity headlines and titles, and I agree that that stuff is wrong. But there are times when something is so important that you need to catch people's attention.
Okay.
And in a world where everyone is fighting for people's attention and their mental real estate, you kind of have to stand out. And sometimes it requires you to twerk a little bit and to be like, it's a free sex here at the back. Free sex!
Hey!
No, I mean sexual education. My bad. But since you guys are here, let's talk about it. You know what I mean? So
what were you trying to get across with that statement?
Exactly what you were saying.
You're just highlighting the problem with the language we use.
Selling the story that everyone must try and start a small business is very misleading and it's wrong.
That is true.
The idea that there are small businesses out there is correct. The idea that small businesses are trying themselves out is great. The idea that small businesses contribute to the economy is really dope. And if you don't have a choice, please go start one. But selling the story that go and start a small business, selling a story that small businesses create jobs and this is being peddled by politicians and their friends who run big businesses,
okay,
who set legislation and regulation that throttles small businesses is disingenuous. And it's leading you on a fool's errand to kind of distract you from doing what's needed. Because the reality is the biggest companies in the world, if they weren't involved in major crimes, they are funded by people that are beneficiaries of major crimes.
Mm.
But they'll never tell you that. They won't tell you, guys, if you're in school, go join a political party, go pay bribes, become a tenderpreneur, and then get rich friends who get you to sit on seats because you're so influential, because you lie to people out there. That's how you become rich. Cyril Ramaphosa, I think this was during COVID, if I'm not mistaken. There's an issue with unemployment, and he's like, I urge kids to try entrepreneurship.
Mm.
I was so pissed. Like, you were pissed. I was so pissed. I was like, fuck you, bro. You guys tell kids to go to school, to study hard, to go to university. And now that they're done, we see medical doctors without jobs. Then you go and gaslight them and you tell them, look into entrepreneurship. Being told by someone who didn't look into entrepreneurship, he went into law and he worked. And then he was handpicked by the Oppenheimer family to become a tool for whatever agenda that they had, going to lie to people. Politicians lie. We know this. But for some of us listening, knowing that there are impressionable kids out there, statements like that are very triggering. And that's why we use our platforms to say the things we say. If kids want to build businesses, they definitely must. If they can build them in entrepreneurship via companies, by all means, if they have to build their own businesses, cool.
Yeah.
But they must fully understand that if you want to scale, you're going to have to break a lot of rules, break a lot of laws, pay a lot of bribes, do things that are not favorable. And they won't tell you that. But if you study almost every company, it's either they have committed crimes or they are funded by people that are beneficiaries of crime. It doesn't work any other way. Even immigrants in this country that are making some type of bank, a lot of them are here illegally so. And they pay whatever bribes they need to. They sell products that are about to or that have expired. They steal certain products of containers. Mm. They do whatever needs to be done. And tomorrow, three generations later, your Nigerian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Zimbabwean, their kids will be at Saint whatever, private school. Their dad will be running a nice consulting company. And it will be like, yeah, but my family follows rules and regulations and we pay tax and we... But if someone was to go to the genesis of how his Nigerian dad got here and got his startup cash, and it's not a nice story to tell. So we're lying to kids out there. At least China didn't lie to their citizens. They were running sweatshops. They were flooding the world with counterfeit goods. And then once they had enough money, they started cleaning up their act. And now they're a great economy. And it's like, look at Huawei, look at BYD, look at what China's doing. And you're like, well, China started off by exploiting and oppressing their citizens. And they were selling fake stuff.
Mm.
Maybe we should start there if you guys are serious. If you're not, look at America. America was built off slavery. If you want to do that, then let's also get slaves, bro. Let's also build a strong military power and go fucking bomb whoever the hell we want. But if we're going to lie to kids and then be shocked, why is our economy stagnating, economic? I'm like, you guys know why, but you want to lie to the people. Hey, then do your thing.
Are you saying, I mean, tenders, I think, the state rather, it's one of the biggest clients for startups.
Yes.
You won't make it actually if you don't have that relationship or you don't have some of those contracts from the state in form of tenders or whatever the process might be. That's one way of growing your business. Are you saying we are faced with just the two? You either go that route where the state is your number one customer, as it is for most businesses, or you have to go the shady route and bribe and have all acts of weirdness into your business.
No, you can run a clean business.
How do you do that?
But how far you scale.
Yeah.
It's either you do shady things or you get funded by people that have done shady things. That's what I'm saying. It's the scalability. Okay. I can get funded by Anglo American.
Okay.
I just got 5 million rand or 5 billion from Anglo. Oh, look at Anglo American's history.
Mm.
I just got a scholarship from Glencore. You know, so, you know, shout out to Glencore. Cool. Look at their history. That's all I'm saying. And look, it's not meant to be that deep, like every billionaire is an evil person. No, no, no. I'm just trying to explain that when you tell kids this story,
yeah,
work hard, apply yourself, pay your taxes, you know, pay the minimum wage, pay your rent, you can't compete. Established farmers in South Africa, Afrikaner farmers that have been here for 8 generations, struggle with loans, with the market, with the pricing, with the 500 hectares of land that they have. They struggle. And you're telling a black kid, get into farming.
Hmm.
The farmers didn't get land at today's rates.
Mm-mm.
They didn't get their startup labor at today's rates. They, at some point, maybe with apartheid, they had subsidies. They had a market that was earmarked just for a white Afrikaner. You're telling a black kid, if you work hard, if you apply yourself, there will be a black kid that will do well in farming, but you'll find out that maybe there was an Afrikaner person who was a beneficiary who liked him and invested in him. Or this kid maybe was stealing cattle from somewhere. Or maybe he was killing other people's produce so that he was the only supplier. Or maybe he was funded by a corrupt ANC government, given free land that he pays 500 rand a year for 1,000 hectares, given access to a market, given a grant, given, and then he's like, look at me, I worked hard and I'm winning. And I'm like, but you're lying. That's not how it worked. So that's my issue.
So when next we have you on the show when we've hit 10 million subs and we're doing a bit of an anniversary thing, and we invite you back onto the show and you know, so we're 10 years down the line, hopefully not that long, but theoretically say 10 years down the line, you're sitting in that chair, we'll be in a, you know, flashy studios and whatnot.
I'd love it if you guys had to remain in studios like this.
But like, What would you like to see in South Africa? Like, what's your ideal? Whether it's coming from yourself, the institutions you're thinking about, that stuff you want to build, or when you're looking at yourself 10 years from now, what's your ideal? What would you want to be talking about?
I asked you off camera what you're hoping to get out of this sit down, and I'd like to answer that first before your question.
Sure.
If you guys want to scale, I've mentioned this to Stan as well. You guys need to look outside of South Africa. Our market is limited, unfortunately. If you can travel, please travel. Interview people from other countries, continents, etc., to try and access their audience. Number two, you have to make certain content that's clickbaity. Discussing the Madlanga Commission, discussing Mkhwanazi, discussing celebrity gossip, you know, Enhle Mbalimlotjwa and Black Coffee just divorced. She might get half of his stuff. Just to pull an audience in who will come here for the party and the free food and then realize there's an educational element to that. So that is just my advice to you guys. If you're trying to scale, if you're not trying to scale and you're happy to be niche, that's cool. Then your challenge becomes traveling the world, finding your niche audience, because it's limited in South Africa. Be consistent as much as you can be. Be true to yourself as much as you can be. It doesn't matter how much of a weirdo nerd that can't speak well. There are probably a billion kids like that out there in the world. You just need to find them. Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Mr. Beast. A lot of these guys are horrible communicators. They look like they have some type of development disorder. And there are so many other loser, weird, nerd kids out there that love them. They're like, that's me, bro. I used to masturbate at night and play video games. There's a lot of them. You just need to find them, and they need to know that you're out there. So be yourself. You don't have to be Stephen Bartlett. You don't have to be Joe Rogan. You don't have to be Candace Owens. You don't have to be David Mashabela, Mac G. Just be yourself. But then the challenge is to find your people. But if you're just trying to scale, then yeah, do the rubbish things that the majority audience wants to hear. It sucks, but clearly that's what they want, because they're useless. They want to watch the circus. So that's my advice to you guys. My wishes for South Africa from my worldviews is, number one, we need to disrupt education. And more each day, I realize that that means we need to build this outside of government. I need our government to be disrupted. I need more nonprofit organizations to stop protesting against government and implement the things that they want to see. So Gift of the Givers is not set up to get the Department of Water Affairs to supply water. They are set up to get water tankers to send water to a community that needs it without begging for whatever. AfriForum, the one that I normally get bashed for, they could be lobbying government. We need Afrikaans schools. We need an Afrikaans university. They didn't do that. They decided to fundraise. They've built an Afrikaans educational institution, a tertiary institution, which focuses on skills, Soltech with Solidarity. They have now invested with other partners in building Afrikaner schools. I think they're called Academia. They are building what they envision. And that's not government. That's not politicians. So if we can get more nonprofit organizations, more civil organizations, more communities taking the destiny of their children and their future into their own hands, I think South Africa will be a better place. Whoever has some type of power, maybe this is government, we need to reimagine our borders. Borders are very controversial. Some type of managing territory is important. I personally believe in more borders than less, by the way, weirdly. I think South Africa needs to go back to cultural blocks. It should be easy to travel, but you should go through some type of a portal, like a toll gate, that a Zulu person is now entering Sotho country. And now that you're in Sotho country, the language that is used is Sesotho and maybe English. But that's where you are. I think we will progress much faster if we have more homogenous communities, personally, which means bring back the Bantustans, bring back apartheid. Again, people hate it when I say this stuff. Doesn't mean bring back the oppression of Black people. Doesn't mean take away Black people's rights. It's saying separate development is going to allow us to thrive quicker. Because if you guys focus on farming and we focus on coding and these people focus on podcasting, we can get further. But if you're forcing the podcasters going to do some farming work and these guys are going, it doesn't work. This happens in schools. It happens in terms of countries. You zone in on what your national identity is. And Zulus are tribalists. It is a thing. We can fight them. We can force them to speak other languages. Or you can be like, be proudly Zulu, but develop KZN as best as it can. And then have good relationships and cordial relationships with Lesotho, with Eswatini and whatever. But respect them. That's who they are. That's who, hey, we're in the Sotho land. We're in the Xhosa land. We respect them, but they must also respect that this is Zulu land. We speak Zulu here, as an example. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see social welfare reducing. We might be forced to see that with the running out of money. But even if we have an abundance of money, I'd like to see less grants. AI and automation are going to disrupt a lot, and we may be forced, our hand may be forced to take people out of jobs regardless. And even people that thought they were safe are going to find themselves needing social welfare for a period. But we need people to go back to the origin of just be human. How do you add value? What does the world need, etc.? And I'd like to see more South Africans traveling more of the world, whether to settle or just for educational purposes, because the more people we have traveling, the more global outlook we'll have, the more talented individuals we'll have here that can make a real impact into the world. I do think we have some special people in this country in particular, and I think they have so much to add the world if they just had platform. And Elon Musk is not the only one. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who's the wealthiest doctor in the world, born in PE, Gqeberha, he's based in Los Angeles now, is another one. Of course, Black Coffee. There's a guy called Vivian Immerman, a Jewish South African who runs an amazing multinational company. Of course, we had Ivan Glassenberg, who was a CA, went to work in Australia for Mark Rich and Company, would run Glencore, etc. If we can get more kids to travel, Black, colored, Indian, white, Afrikaans, to just travel the world and have platforms. I think Rudolf Botha as well is part of the PayPal mafia, the Silicon Valley guys. We can really shift the world. There's something special about this geography in the world. There's something special about it. And we've got so much to share in the world, in our culture, in our music, in our ideas. We could actually transform social media, AI, how companies operate. I mean, the concepts of Ubuntu, Stockfels, our minibus taxi systems, and how those could be formalized internationally for better usage. The way we farm here, the way we practice medicine here, the food that is indigenous to us. Yeah, I've already mentioned music and the like. I mean, your Lion Kings, your Black Panthers, those things have got a South African flavor. And I think we have a lot to offer the world. We just need platforms, i.e. entrepreneurs, i.e. innovators outside of government to find ways to solve those problems and to share them with the world.
All right. Then you are the Black Pen.
Boom.
Thank you so much for making the time. Unfortunately, I know you have to run and be somewhere else.
Not a problem. Scott, so Stan.
Yeah.
Thank
you so much. And shout out to the guys that are working in the background, Ndibo, Samge, Sne, and to all your viewers as well. Guys, click like, subscribe, share this with your friends. If we can build platforms like this, we can create jobs. We can bring more money from outside of the country into the country to develop this country. And then you guys will benefit in that way. But it starts with you guys clicking, liking, subscribing, commenting, and sharing with your friends.
100%.
And you're the Black Pen. Thank you.